Okay, so let us begin for this evening with the some Pali chanting. Probably good to... Gia, do you want to close the door? Thanks. We don't want to get any noise complaints. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammāsambuddho vidyācārana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manussanam buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhikiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Yadidam chattari purisa yugani artha purisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakirneyo anjali karaniyo anutaram punyaketam lokasati. Right, just changing my seat chair.
Welcome
back to Deepika Radha. You've been away in Sri Lanka for a while. How's Sri Lanka? It's good. apologies for the weather. It's Not much we can do about that, unfortunately. Okay, so we're running a little bit late today because there was a class here before we started, so we were kicked back. As you see, we have a special mood lighting now. So many changes. That also seems like a very squeaky chair, but anyway. We should do squeak tests of chairs before we set them out. Anyway, moving along. Okay, so for this evening, we're going to begin with some meditation, and we'll do a bit of guided meditation. We'll have a short break, and then we'll come back for some Dhamma talk. So let us begin. You can try another chair if that one is extremely squeaky. You might get better luck. Is that better? We're going to have to squeak test all of these chairs. Anyway. All right. So, again, apologies for being a little bit late today. And we can't control all of these things all the time because it's a shared space. But I think also is a nice reminder of impermanence and of the virtues of patience. Patience is one of those virtues which we seem to have decided doesn't matter. So we've decided that the world that we want to live in is a world where we can get whatever we want, whenever we want. And the measure of the virtue or the goodness of something is how fast it can give me what I want. And if we sort of, you know, think about like how that's going to go in the future, you know, you can probably imagine not too far down the line that you'd be like, I don't know, going in your private self-driven car where you'll be like surfing TikTok on your car, and then somebody has eating a pizza, and then you think pizza, yum, and then something's reading your brain and then sends a thing to ping an advertisement for pizza, and you go, yeah. So they cook a pizza, they send out a drone with a pizza oven in it that flies to your car while you're traveling, and then like 2 minutes later you get a freshly cooked piping hot slice of pizza just delivered to you right there, and then we'll be like, that's just great, that's the world I want to live in. Or not, right? So the Buddha believed that moderation was good. And so sometimes we get what we want, and it's good to get what we want, but it's also good to have a bit of patience sometimes. And the virtue of patience is something that I really observed when I was in Thailand and I was practicing as a young monk in a rural environment. And you can see that rural or agricultural society lends itself very much to patience, because you can't make plants grow, you just have to wait for that time of year. And so there was a natural rhythm where people would work very hard doing very difficult, uncomfortable work, like wading through the rice paddies, bending over all day, planting the rice seedlings, moving them, all of this stuff is really hard, painful, laborious work for not very much return. And yet people would do that really hard work when it was the time. But when it was also the time to not work, then they would not work. And they would take, there was long times of the year when there would be time to relax, time they would have like parties where we were in all night in Isan, they would have like all night parties and so on. And, or they might just do other, you know, other things that they had put off for the harvest time and so on. So all I'm saying here is that there's a kind of a rhythm to things. There's a period of working, a period of rest, and it's not like on all the time. And I think we've sort of convinced ourselves that we need to be on 24/7, and that's a kind of virtue. And if we can hack our way into not sleeping and just work all the time, then that would be even better. And the notion of meaningful, healthy rest is not just rest, is not just an absence of work, but is a time of rejuvenation. Now, when we approach meditation, we can think of meditation as being a profound kind of spiritual rest. Like we often talk about meditation in very active terms. We talk about it as practice. We talk about it as doing meditation. And we talk about it as proceeding through stages of meditation. And so we frame it in ways that are quite workful, but we can also frame meditation in ways that are quite restful. And so meditation is putting down of the burden. Meditation is letting go. Meditation is the cessation of activities, right? It's the stilling of things, the samatha of things. So when we approach meditation, then it is that poised, active sense of conscious rest which leads the mind into a deeper state of stillness and a deeper state of cognitive awareness. And one of the things that we realize through that is that there is a potential for knowing, a potential for awareness and consciousness, which the mind has by virtue of its function. Like it innately functions in a way so as to know things. And that function of knowing things is sometimes obscured by all of the things that we do. It's even obscured by the things that we do to try to make the mind better, right? We can even through our practice of meditation, then that can be another burden. It can be another expectation. We can have too much, oh, I want to do this, I want to get this, I want to achieve this. And the Buddha had a name for that, and that's called dhammudacca, or just udacca, is restlessness. So that feeling in meditation that you want to move it along quicker, want to get further, right? Then this is a lack of contentment and a lack of stillness. But one of the things that happens in meditation practice is that people will often realize a beautiful state of meditation, or you know, maybe a so-so state of meditation, or at least a state of meditation that's not quite as bad as the ordinary creptacular mind mess. Okay, it's a little bit better to rise above the ocean for a minute and glimpse that there might be some clarity and peace. Okay, then everything's back to normal again. So then immediately what people think is, how can I get back there? Right? How can I get back there? But the problem is, of course, there's no there, right? That wasn't a thing, that wasn't a sort of objectively existing place that you can then go back to. It was just a state of the mind which emerged because of the causes and conditions that were present in the mind at that time. So there's no going back, right? So when we meditate, Adinchā used to say you have to reach a place where there's no going forward, there's no going back, and there's no standing still, right? So it's a very profound statement on the nature of meditation. And that, incidentally, is similar to some statements in the Sagatawagga and the Samyutta Nikaya. But anyway, my point here is that even standing still is still like doing the activity of standing still. So standing still is actually just another kind of activity. So in our meditation, we're constantly, as in the progress of our meditation, we're constantly like pushing ahead or falling behind or holding onto that state in the middle. And but the deeper that we go, the more we learn to trust letting go. And when we learn to trust letting go, we find that the mind reveals itself with clarity and brilliance. Let's do some meditation. So sitting quietly. And allowing the mind to settle back into the body. Now, letting that gentle feeling of the breath come in, and breath go out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Letting that soft and gentle feeling of the breath soothe you and calm you.
And when your mind starts wandering off, just be aware of it. Let the stillness of the mind bring you back to peace. Don't be worried or fretting about when your mind is thinking or when it's moving. These are natural forces and movements and processes in the mind. That's how your mind works. And being frustrated or upset with them is like being upset with the ocean for having waves. Okay, so now coming near to the end of the meditation. Bring your mind back to the sounds around you. To the sensations inside your body. Giving yourself a minute to just come back to normal. And then cast your mind back over the course of the meditation and look closely and specifically at what happened at each part of the meditation. What was your mind like at the beginning of the meditation? How did it change? What was it like at each stage in the meditation? Was there any, what was dragging you away from stillness? What was it like to let go? And finally, what is your mind like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So let's just have a short break, grab a cup of tea, and I'll see you back here in a minute. Okay, welcome back, everybody. A couple of comments here. Let me just address these briefly. Number one, Marion says, is the Dhammapada uttered by the Buddha himself, or rather lines uttered by close disciples, probably enlightened? Is the language the same as the suttas or different? Thank you for your teaching at time. So just very briefly, Dhammapada's got quite an unusual text in that the text itself does not attribute itself. Like most of the suttas, it says, oh, this was what the Buddha said. The Dhammapada just has a series of verses, and we kind of assume that they were spoken by the Buddha. Most of the Dhammapada verses are obviously early, and it represents, you know, basically the same teaching that you find in the suttas and similar language and so on. A lot of the verses are shared in common with the suttas. It's also shared widely in common with other Dhammapadas in other literature. So Sanskrit, Tibetan, Gandhari, Chinese, we find many different Dhammapadas, all of them some differences, but all of them very similar in terms of the topics treated and the style and the manner and so on. So it certainly behave. I can't say where all the verses came from. Some of the verses and lines are probably, certainly some of the lines, are probably pre-Buddhist in the sense that everyone was borrowing from everyone else. It's probably like a compilation with different kinds of things in there. But certainly the teaching style and the teachings are very the same as what we find in the early suttas. See there's a drastic shift in the teaching from in the late canonical texts, which you can see like the introduction of things like the Baramis and the like the idea of determining past lives and many different kinds of things, which are not found in the suttas at all. So within what we consider the early Buddhist texts, there's kind of minor variations in perspective and so on. But then between those early Buddhist texts and then even the late canonical stage, it's actually quite different. If you compare, say, the Teri and Theragata, the verses of the elder bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and you compare that, which is part of the early canonical texts, and then if you compare that with the late canonical, Theragatapada and Theripadana, then it's very different. The content is very different. So, yeah. Anyway, so Venerable Prasanna suggests we can use some WD-40 to resolve our squeaky chair issue. Thank you for that, Venerable Prasanna. Practical as always. That is excellent. Reminds me of the time I was in Ipoh
And you know that opportunity, like when you're a monastic or something like that, you get the chance to like hang out with some of these renowned teachers and masters. And I was in Ipoh, and Venerable Paok Sayadaw visited, and I was like, oh, great teacher, we can hang. So anyway, we went to his talk and these kinds of things. We're sitting around, and he sort of like points to the window and says, oh, what's that? And then just pointed to the sealant on the window that they had there. And I said, oh, it's like silicon sealant. He's like, oh. So, of course, we spent the next day driving around Ipoh to all of the hardware stores looking for silicon sealant so he could get it for his monastery back in. And everyone, because Malaysian people are very devoted, so like every hardware store, they'd be out there with like people, they'd be wearing bare feet because he was very strict with Vinaya, so he had bare feet. So everyone would take all their shoes off, and then there'd be people going beetling ahead of us with like buckets of water and towels to wash our feet and dry them before we went into the hardware stores and so on. So anyway, that was our experience with Pat Oxidor. Okay. And Echo Chamber says, should Buddhists align with Asian or other military regimes to guarantee their survival so the sacred Dhamma teachings may be passed on? No, under no circumstances should Buddhists ever align with military regimes. They shouldn't align with any kind of regime. And the Dhamma should be a moral voice which is able to speak the truth regardless of its alliance with different kinds of power. And if you think that kowtowing to fascists is going to protect you, may I present to you the entirety of world history as a counterexample for that. So moving along, for today, so we're starting now, a couple of weeks into the Rains Retreat. And we've had a bit of a bumpy start to the Rains Retreat. We were subjected to cancel culture that one week, right? We were like cancel cultured and we couldn't even hold the talk, right? I'm like, come on. It's like the Buddha literally invented woke. Like, he's literally the woke one. I mean, that's what the Buddha means, right? I mean, how can we possibly be cancel cultured? We're supposed to be canceling everyone else. I don't understand it. But anyway, so we were canceled one week because of the noise. And then last week we did the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and looking at the Four Noble Truths. And so usually when we come to the Rains Retreat, I usually like to pick a particular kind of theme or something like that to structure the talks over that. And so for this Rains Retreat, by popular demand, okay? And by popular demand, I mean that nobody has asked for this, okay? So I am going to do a series of talks on dependent origination. Yes, I know, everyone's favorite topic. Okay, so number one, I want you to know that what we're going to do here, that my basic strategy with this, okay, I'm going to go over dependent origination in excruciating detail. Okay, there is going to be so much technical lingo. There is going to be so many existential dimensions. There are going to be historical discursions. There are going to be complex interweavings of all kinds of things. And by the end of it, I guarantee you will be longing for release. Okay. All right. So let's begin today talking about dependent origination. All right, so for this week, I'll give like a bit of an introduction, an overview, and then we will tease out various aspects of it as we go on. So dependent origination, one of the core Buddhist teachings, and one of the teachings that is always regarded as the most characteristic of the Buddha himself. And we know the Buddha adopted many different kinds of teachings and so on, but the dependent origination was something that's very characteristic of Buddhism and is always regarded by Buddhists as being a core or even the core teaching. When Asaji was asked for the essence of the teachings, Putta, before Sariputta was a monk, he said, what the Buddha teaches is those things that arise from a cause and their cessation. This is what the Tathagatas teach. And so he's identifying dependent origination as the key teaching of the Dhamma. So when the Buddha taught causality and conditionality in many different ways, in many different contexts, okay? So the idea that there is, that we can understand the world through causes and conditions is found throughout all of the different dimensions of the Buddha's teachings. But when we refer to dependent origination, we typically are referring to one specific presentation of that idea, and that's a specific list of 12 links of conditions, right? So they call it like the 12 factors of dependent origination, okay? So again, I just want to make clear that distinction. There's a general idea that things are caused and there's conditionality, and on the other hand, there's the specific teaching we call dependent origination, which is that 12 links. Now, those 12 links are often presented just as they are. They are also often presented in terms of with changes. Some things may be left out, some things may be added, presentation of them can be altered, and so on. And so we will look into some of those things as the course goes on. And so I want to focus on like the meaning and the importance of dependent origination, especially as it's presented in like specific contexts for specific purposes. Like why are these parts emphasized in this case? Why are we drawing out that particular conclusion in that case? And try to understand how that teaching is being used in order to further liberation. But to do that, we have to begin with a general presentation of dependent origination. Now, the main dependent origination is taught all through the Buddhist scriptures, but the main collection of scriptures on it is the Nidana Sanghita, which is Sanghita Nikaya number 12, and then that contains, I can't remember how many, probably a couple of hundred discourses on dependent origination. The first two spell out the basic list of dependent origination, and then they define all of those terms. And so for this particular talk, I'm going to focus on just the list of terms and on the definitions of those list of terms, all right? So apologies if it's a little bit like a dictionary for today, but anyway, hopefully we can at least clarify some things. Understanding these definitions then helps us to use those definitions wherever else we encounter those terms. That's how the Buddha structured his teaching, right? He would use the same terms in lots of different cases. Most of the times he would leave them unexplained. But then when he would explain them, then that meaning is then meant to be applied in all of those different cases. Now, we cannot solve all of the problems and understand all the depths of dependent origination just from understanding these links and these terms, but what that can do is it can help to clarify certain details and to rule out certain possible misunderstandings of what the Buddha was talking about, okay? So let's begin. First factor. So the 12 factors, ignorance, choices or sankharas, consciousness, nama, rupa, name and form, the six senses, salaya, yatana, then contact, feeling, craving, grasping, and then existence or continuation of existence, and rebirth, and then old age, and death, and all of that fun stuff. So that's more or less the 12 links. Let me go through and describe them in a little bit more detail. So the first one is always? Ignorance. Excellent. You know that. You know that ignorance is the first one. So does that mean that you're not ignorant? If you know something, you can't be ignorant of it, right? So the Buddha said, if you know something, therefore you're not going to suffer. But you're still suffering? So something's gone wrong here. Maybe ignorance has a bit of a deeper meaning than we think. Maybe just because we know the word ignorance doesn't mean that we actually know what ignorance is. Yeah? So the idea of ignorance, right, what the Buddha is pointing to here is that the thing that trips us up is the thing that we don't know, right? And this already is quite interesting and sort of quite profound from a philosophical and psychological point of view, because we all like to know things and we like to think that we know things. And so we tend to dwell and focus on what are those things that we know. And the task of overcoming ignorance, kind of a lot of work, actually, right? Learning stuff is hard. See, we've got a couple of school students there. They're nodding. Yes, learning stuff is hard, right? And then you learn it. What happens next? You forget it again. Bloody hell. Why even bother, right? But you still, something sticks there, right? You don't forget everything, right? But the more that you learn how to learn, the more that you come to know how to know, then the easier it is. And when you understand something, it's really pleasant, right? So just think about, I want you to think about that moment just for 1 minute, right? That moment when you don't know, yeah? And it can be just a very small thing. You're driving along, do I turn left or do I turn right? And when you don't know something, or maybe you're in the class, teacher says, you know, what's the answer to this problem? You don't know. And when you don't know something, then there's a certain tension inside you, right? It doesn't feel good, yeah? And then, oh, you know. Oh, hang on, that's the answer. Oh, I need to go this way. And when that knowledge arises, it feels good, right? So knowledge is actually associated with happiness, yeah? It's always nice to know things. And so that ignorance is then the thing that leads us to make bad choices. So the second factor here is independent origination is choices or sankharas. Now, when we say ignorance here, just to be clear, is that we don't just mean not knowing the answer to a maths problem or not knowing the way to our destination, but we mean ignorance of like what life is about and why it is that we suffer. So ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. We talked about the Four Noble Truths last week. So if we don't know the Four Noble Truths, what happens is that we keep on suffering and we keep on incurring pain and causing pain for ourselves and for others, and we don't know why. And we keep blundering around trying to get better. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And we seem to get deeper and deeper as it goes. So this is really the problem here with ignorance. And yet somehow, even though we are ignorant, we still have to live. And in order to live, we have to make choices, right? And so we have this word sankharas. Now, sankhara is a very kind of interesting word, and it's one of the most tricky to catch in English. And there are many very different translations of sankharas, and one of the processes that you have to go through when you encounter Buddhism, certainly for me as a young monk, I think all kind of young monastics or whatever, you have to go through a period where you're like, what's the right translation of sankhara? And you're like, no, all of these ones are wrong and this one is the right one. And so I went through that like 3 or 4 times or 5 or 6 times to try to find an understanding. And I'll talk more about that later and about the meaning of it, right? But when I translate sankharas as choices here, okay, this is not meant to be a complete or even particularly a philosophically precise translation of sankharas, okay? It's meant to be an ordinary language translation that captures the main point of the word sankharas in this particular context, okay? So the main point is that we make choices because we don't know what we're doing, okay? I'll talk more about the different dimensions of the word sankharas later on, okay? So this is one of the things you have to make that compromise in translation. So we're ignorant, right? We don't know what causes us suffering and pain, but somehow we still have to live, right? You still have to do stuff. And to do stuff, you have to make choices. And sometimes you make a good choice and it leads to happiness. Sometimes you make a bad choice, it leads to suffering, right? And that's what we're talking about here. Now, so far we can understand how this matters in terms of our so far we can understand this in terms of our just everyday psychology, right? These are things that happen to us all the time. We don't know what we're doing. We make a choice, okay? And we do this all the time. You go to a restaurant. You want something to eat. You don't know, what is this food? Is this one going to be good? Is that one going to be good? You don't know which one is right, but you make a choice anyway, okay? And the food comes out. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's not, but you have to live with it, yeah? So this then brings up the next link in dependent origination, which is consciousness, okay? So this area of dependent origination and the way that the links work together is very subtle, and I'm not going to try to unravel all of these here. But the basic idea is that consciousness or choices constitutes a kind of energy that empowers our consciousness and propels consciousness into a new life. And so the world that we live in is created by sankharas, and the river that flows from one world to another is the river of awareness or consciousness, okay? Now, consciousness on one hand is the six kinds of sense consciousness, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental consciousness, mental awareness. So the point here is that what moves from one life to another, that stream of consciousness, that's a term that the Buddha himself used, the vijnana sota, the stream of consciousness, that stream of consciousness from one life to the next is driven and empowered by those sankharas, those choices that we make. In other words, to put it simply, if you make good choices in this life, you get a good rebirth in the next life. Yay! Make bad choices. We don't like to think about that too much because that's not going to be fun in the next life, right? The purpose of dependent origination is to step out of this whole thing altogether, right? Okay, so consciousness. So consciousness, the root meaning or the basic meaning of consciousness you have to bear in mind, a Pali vijnana, is that consciousness is the awareness of what is happening, right? Consciousness is always a complex and conditioned phenomenon. It arises depending on causes and conditions. We are aware of a sound. We are aware of a thought arising in our mind. And consciousness itself, awareness itself, is the most subtle and hard to pinpoint dimension of our mind because it is the subjectivity. It's that which knows everything, but which itself cannot be known. So I'm going to come back to all of these things, but this is the basic understanding of consciousness. Next one, we have nama rupa. Again, another tricky term to translate, usually translated as name and form, which is actually pretty good translation as long as we sort of know what we're talking about, okay? So nama is literally name, okay? So same word as the English name. In fact, the English word name was actually pronounced nama up until a few hundred years ago. They had what they call the great vowel shift in English, and so now we pronounce it differently, but it was pronounced nama up until quite recently. So it just means a name, and a form means, in a basic sense, it means your body, okay? So every one of us has our own nama and our own rupa, our own name and our own form, and that defines who we are as individuals, all right? So this is like a basic idea of what nama rupa is. Okay, it's an ordinary language sense. If you said to somebody in India 2,000 or 3,000 years ago about nama rupa, that's what they would think. They think, oh, nama is your name, your rupa is your body, right? So your nama rupa is like, that's who you are. I'm so and such a person. And same thing like you might have in your passport, right? You have a name and you have like a picture or an image of you, and then that's who you are, right? But of course, it's not who you are. Right? But that's who we take to represent who we are, right? So this is the basic idea of nama rupa. So the Buddha then analyzed that and gave an analytical interpretation of it, which we'll come back to in future weeks, but I just wanted to leave that for now. So one way we can think about this is that vijnana, stream of consciousness, is that which we make choices out of ignorance. Those choices create an energy that energy empowers or moves that stream of consciousness. And then from that stream of consciousness, a new individual will grow, a new nama and rupa will grow. And then that new individual, that new nama rupa, will grow six senses, right? We call the salayatana. So the six senses is relatively straightforward to understand compared to some of the other ones. So we have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and the mind is the sixth sense. And all of these are ways in which consciousness becomes aware of the world. Now, why do we include the mind as the sixth sense? Obviously, the mind is different to the other five senses. And there are plenty of places where the Buddha analyzes the mind as being working in a quite different way than the five external senses. However, when we present the sixth sense, the idea is that we learn by analogy. We learn by moving from things that are simple towards things that are complex. And so we can understand the structure of consciousness by understanding how our eye works. Okay, you have an eye in here, right? You have light that stimulates the eye out there. You have consciousness that's aware of that. You have the contact, the coming together of all of those things. You have a process of perception that recognizes what those things are. You have feelings that come out. You have desires that come out, and so on. And so we can understand the structure of our sense experience from understanding our eye. And then we can understand the ear, nose, tongue, and body in the same way. And we can understand and analyze mental experience in a similar way. That's why we have the six senses. Right? It gives us an analytical framework and a perspective by which we can learn to understand something about how the mind works, because how the mind works is in some ways similar to how the other senses work. All right. So the six senses are conditions for contact. So contact in Pali is pasa, literally means touch. And it's the impact in the five external senses. It's the contact of a material something. Okay, this is actually really quite a subtle point in dependent origination. So there has to be some physical impact in order to create some kind of sensory stimulation. And this is what the sense organs are grown in order to do. Okay, so we, as organisms, like our consciousness and our nama rupa, cooks up these sense organs in order to be able to contact the world outside so that we can operate in the world outside. So we can walk along and not bump into the wall because we see that the wall is there. Okay. Other things as well, but that's an important one. Okay. And mental contact is again more subtle because mental contact depends on conceptualization. Okay, so contact. Contact is a condition of feeling. Ow, right? When you experience something, you have a feeling about that thing. You like it or you don't like it, right? And then you have craving. Ah, I want it, I don't want it. And so these obviously go back to very basic, very primordial evolutionary beginnings, right? Something is either food, right? It's either the eaten or the eater. This is what kind of the basic level of a desire, right? It's either the eaten or the eater. I can eat it or it's going to eat me, right? And even before, say, sexual desire or anything like that, and there's plenty of organisms that don't have sex, right? Just divide or whatever. But they all eat. Like all beings have to eat. It's a primal thing. And so that desire, what we call craving, arises in response to feeling. So we feel something pleasant, we want more of it. We feel something painful, we want to get rid of it. Neither pleasant nor painful, we don't pay attention to it, we don't care about it. So the root for craving, like the root word for what we translate as craving, is tanha, and the root meaning of that is thirst. Okay, so tanha in pre-Buddhist texts always means thirst, but in Buddhism it usually means craving. Rarely means, doesn't mean literally thirst in Buddhism, but it means craving. So this is, so craving is a kind of primordial desire. Okay, so think of craving as like, you're like a one-celled organism just moving out of the ooze. And you're just able, I'm going to come out of this ooze because I can absorb this particle of food, right? So this is what craving does. It impels us. And if you think about it, we're not so different, right? I mean, if you're like a literally one-celled organism living in the ooze on the bottom of the ocean, you'll move out of your ooze in order to get some food. It's the same thing you do when you're sitting at home and you're thinking, maybe I'm a bit hungry. I'm going to move out of my chair and go and get something to eat. You're not that different, okay? And so craving is that which animates us and moves us towards getting things, right? So the next one is grasping. And grasping is similar in meaning to craving. And it's kind of curious that if we look at the Buddhist traditions, that there's always been a kind of an interpretive problem on why both of these factors are here. Because normally, craving and grasping, that's tanha and upadana, normally these are used in more or less synonymous ways in Buddhism. And yet here they're presented as two different factors. And this is discussed quite extensively in the Theravada commentaries and different books. And I found it quite interesting one time when I read a book by the Dalai Lama on dependent origination. And his presentation of dependent origination was so similar to the one that I was used to from a Theravadan perspective that he even had the same interpretive problem in dealing with craving and upadana, right? So that even the interpretive issues were still the same. So I think that the difference here is that whereas craving is a primordial desire, okay? Craving is a primordial desire. Upadana is a bit more sophisticated. Upadana is described as being the attachment or the grasping to sensual pleasures, to to virtue and vows, to views of a self. And to, what's the last one? Last one of the four cravings is, graspings is, just views, right? Ditto padanas, right? So grasping at views, grasping at precepts and observances, and grasping at theories of a self. So these are obviously all quite sophisticated, okay? A theory of a self is not something that is shared with primordial ooze. As far as I'm known, like I don't want to discriminate, okay? It may be that primordial ooze has more consciousness than I'm aware of, okay? But as far as I know, it doesn't have a theory of itself. Even dogs don't have a theory of itself, okay? And just to be clear here, by theory of itself, we don't mean the theory of itself in the same way that's used in psychology when they will say like a dog can look itself in the mirror and will recognize itself. So that wouldn't be really called a theory of self in Buddhism. So theory of self means I have articulated an idea and I can say that myself consists of this body with its four elements, which will then grow and live for its whole life. And then when this body dies, the self will disappear, right? That's a theory of self, okay? So what we mean is that, so that's obviously, right? Even human infants don't have a theory of self. Right? But it is something that people will usually develop as they grow older. Similar thing with attachment to precepts and observances, right? Virtue and vows, right? Sila Bhatta Padana, right? Typically, your average kangaroo is not particularly attached to performing religious services in a particular way. Okay, so human beings might say, let's have a schism because you want to perform the mass in Latin and we're going to do it in English. Okay, this is attachment to rites and rituals, attachment to sila padana. Or we might do something like saying that if only I can recite so many verses, then I'm going to get enlightened. Or we might think that the true virtue of the spiritual life means showing up for the Dhamma talks and sitting there with a pious expression in my face while not looking or listening to anything that happens or understanding or putting it into practice. So this would be another... What? Nothing personal, okay? I wasn't meaning any of you, obviously. Obviously, okay? But anyway, so that's the kind of thing, okay? And then attachment to views is more kind of a general thing. It's similar to attachment to the views of self. Of course, the Buddha would say that ultimately all, you know, views depend on the view of self. But attachment to the views and theories about different kinds of things, for example, like different kind of cosmological ideas or philosophical ideas and so on and so forth. So these are things like views in themselves are necessary. We'll talk more about this later on, but views themselves obviously are necessary and good, but when we get attached to them, then they can create suffering. Moving along, so look, just a word for whoever it is that's naming themselves echo chamber here. Could you please stop asking these kinds of questions? I feel like really that you're just here to troll us all. So if you could either just I don't have any problem with answering these kinds of questions, but I feel like giving a series of these questions in this way is kind of trolling behavior. So I'm going to be ignoring that. Thank you. Okay. Moving along. Where was I? Yes, grasping, craving. Next one, we've done feeling, we've done contact, we've done craving, we've done grasping. Okay, the next one is existence, or we call bhava. So existence is, there's three usually analyzed as three kinds of existence. A sense sphere existence, which is where we are here. We have all the senses and so on. We also have the form existence, rupa bhava, which is where you go if you practice the four jhanas. And you have the arupa bhava, which is where you go if you practice the formless attainments, the arupa loka. So the idea of bhava is very compact and quite pregnant in its implications. In a way, bhava or existence includes all of the other things. And which is why if you look, say, at what they call the Tibetan wheel of life, like the Pali for the wheel of life is a bhava chakra. It actually includes all of those 12 factors. So in one sense, it's one of the links, but it's also like the whole thing is the wheel of bhava. And we can translate bhava as life or existence. But what it really refers to is this ongoing continuity where one life moves on to the next, moves on to the next, moves on to the left. It's a flow and a continually creating process where the way that we live and the things that we do in this life manifest in terms of shaping what we will experience in the future. So this is very briefly the idea of bhava. Next one, then bhava, of course, if we're going to get reborn, we're going to get reborn in a particular form, and we call this rebirth. So the Pali here is jati, often translated as birth. Birth is actually not quite correct because in English, the word birth refers usually to being to childbirth, to be emerging from the womb, when a baby emerges from the womb, whereas that is actually a different word in Pali. That's vijati in Pali. What we call jati or rebirth is the where a person is born or conceived in a womb in the human existence and then continues that cycle. So described as being the rebirth and conception of the various sentient beings and the various orders of sentient beings. So this is rebirth. And just to be clear, some people will say that rebirth has like a psychological meaning, so it can be like a spiritual rebirth or the birth of a sense of self in the present moment. And these are all incorrect, actually. This is not what dependent origination is talking about, and these are not accurate descriptions of what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about birth in this particular case. Next is old age and death, jara marana. So once you're born, you will get old and die. Thank you so much for that reminder of impermanence. No, that's great. Excellent. That's excellent. Thank you for that. We've learned the lesson now. That's good. We don't need it a second time. But anyway, moving on. So old age and death, described by the Buddha as old age is broken teeth, gray hair, wrinkly skin, diminished vitality, and failing faculties. It's a very vivid description, isn't it? Yeah. So old age and death emerge from birth. So this is actually a subtle but very important dimension of the Buddha's teachings. You see, because normally we want to have birth, we think birth is good, but we don't want to have death because we think death is bad. So when someone's born, we celebrate, and when someone dies, we mourn. But it's kind of weird, right? So the Buddha is actually saying that these things are all part of that natural process, right? If you're going to have birth, then you're going to have old age and death. And because you're going to have old age and death, you're going to have sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress. So these are the fundamental factors in dependent origination. Once more, ignorance is a condition for choices. Choice is a condition for consciousness. Consciousness is a condition for name and form. Name and form are conditions for the six sense fields. Six sense fields are conditions for contact. Contact is a condition for feeling. Feeling is a condition for craving. Craving is a condition for grasping. Grasping is a condition for continued existence. Continued existence is a condition for rebirth. Rebirth is a condition for old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress to come to be. That's how this whole mass of suffering originates. So that's the bad news. Good news? Yes, with the cessation of ignorance, all of that comes to an end, and suffering comes to an end as well, which, just so we're clear, is the actual point. Right, so the point is not this is the dependent origination is not a doctrine of determinism. It's not saying that we're locked hopelessly in this cycle of dependent origination. It is saying that it is possible, because the Buddha points to those things. He points especially to ignorance. And I just want to linger on that just for one minute. When we look at ignorance, that dark mass of ignorance, then it can often seem impossible or unbelievable that anybody can really overcome that. But the reality is that each of us have seen ignorance and overcome ignorance on countless times. It happens literally every day. It's probably happened multiple times as you've been sitting here listening to the talk, that you haven't known something and then you did. And that might be in terms of a fact. It might be in terms of being aware of your posture. It might be in terms of like recognizing a memory that comes up. It could be anything. But we're actually constantly knowing. And the Buddha is pointing to the fact that knowing and understanding, which is a normal function of the human mind, can actually lead to undoing this whole round of suffering. So this is a very brief introduction to dependent origination. And like I said, I will be continuing this in subsequent weeks, and hopefully you will join me for this journey, and we can learn something together. That would be fun, wouldn't it? Yeah? Okay. Good. Excellent. So we've got a couple of questions here online. Let me answer the questions here. That's correct. There was a course given by myself and Venerable Mali a couple of years ago on dependent origination. I just lost my connection, so I'm just back in again. Okay. So yes, there is that thing. Moving on. Look, I've done various things on dependent origination over the years, so I'm not sure what's around. Good question. So Tim asks, does it mean that, say, the same dog has less or no upadana, no grasping, depending, assuming dependent origination applies to all planes of existence? Yes, that's true. So I think, like, normally we assume that in Buddhism, that if you're, say, animals or, let's say, infants are not held to be morally responsible for their actions in the same way that adults are. I'm not saying that they're completely devoid of moral responsibility, but not to the same level, right? And so, and I think that that's because they don't have the upadana. It means that their actions are, their actions are still driven by craving, right? There's this some primal desires and so on, but it's not really sort of conscious and premeditated in the same way. And that's what focuses and directs karma and makes it into a constructive force. So yes, I would say that dogs. I'm not saying they don't have any upadana. I'm just saying that the upadana it's not really functional and effective in the same way or to the same degree, maybe just to a small degree compared to humans. Sumana says, Bhante, is it true that a being continues a stream of consciousness through each world system in every rebirth, learning new lessons of the Dhamma until all are complete and ignorance is fully uprooted? I don't know if the suttas really say that you sort of have to go through all the different realms. I mean, the Buddha did say that he had himself gone through all the different realms. And, so presumably you're learning lessons, but you also forget things, right? So learning is not necessarily a linear process. Interestingly enough, Socrates believed that we had all learned everything in our past lives. So this is why we have the word education in English. So to educate is to educe, literally to draw out, right? And the reason we use the word education is it goes back to Socrates, who believed that we know everything and we just have to draw out that knowledge. So education is about drawing out the things you know rather than putting in the things. Yeah? Interesting, isn't it? So Letty says, thanks. No worries, Letty. I'm glad that I could keep you awake. That's excellent. Simran, am I referring to relative ignorance we can overcome with relative knowing in this world? Yes. Reflective of the removal of actual ultimate ignorance in the ultimate world. Yes, exactly. So yes, that's true, but these are not completely different things. Okay, so the wisdom that sees through suffering and that finds freedom is not a different completely from the wisdom that knows how to answer the crossword puzzle. I mean, it's fairly different in most respects, right? But it's not totally different in every respect. Okay, fine. Gillian says, thanks. No worries, Gillian. Chandima says, Nama rips. I agree, Nama does rip. Oh, hang on, no, probably a typo for Nama Rupa. Sorry, Chandima. Sometimes translated as mentality and physicality. Is that correct? Yeah, that's another way of translating it. I'll talk more about that in future talks. Yeah, we'll go a bit more into detail with those things. Anima asks, why does rebirth not correspond to the psychological or meditative experience of a self constructing itself? Because it's specifically defined by the Buddha so as to not mean that. The Buddha says this is what rebirth is, the birth of different kinds of beings in different orders of beings. So you can make an analogy from that to different kinds of things, but it's clearly not what the Buddha was actually talking about. It's not to say that that's an invalid concept. It's simply to say that it's not what dependent origination is about. Again, I'll talk more about all of these things as time goes on. But are there any questions for any of the folks here? Yeah.
The sense of self that was
under the right.
Is that similar to Sakkāya
Ditthi
or something else?
That's right, similar to Sakkāya Ditthi, yeah. So the theory of a self is basically the same as Sakkāya Ditthi.
It's like a very deep down thing of what's me here and the world outside that differentiates.
That's correct, yeah. But because it's a view or a doctrine, like it's an actual articulation of it, like you might, it doesn't have to be like a philosophical theory about it, right? It doesn't mean you have to sit down and write a paper saying this is what my theory of self is, right? But it's more like it's the way that you think about yourself, right? If you want to understand more about how you construct your theory of self, right, then in your meditation, pay attention to the I statements, right? When you're thinking and when you think I, look at what you're actually saying when you think I, yeah, because that's revealing something about you, the way that you're constructing yourself, Yeah. And then if you're thinking, and then you think you, right, then you're constructing yourself in relation to other. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions here? Got a couple more online. Anyone else? Yeah. Yes, Eka.
I'm really intrigued with the concept in hypnotic. Take this example of when we were a kid and then we study some subjects. We won't have it on capacity and capability.
Right.
So where does ignorance come in? Seventh, I'm not good in math.
Okay.
But I'm good at something else.
Okay.
Does it mean I choose to do that? Or then I become ignorant of the thing that I don't?
Yeah, can be, yeah. So you choose, that can be one tendency, right? You choose to do the things that you're good at. Right? And I mean, that's natural to do that, but I think it's also good to challenge yourself, right? So if there's something that you're not good at, then if you put the effort into learning that, then that's going to pay off later on, right? Because the only reason that we have talents in certain areas is because, well, we did put the work in at one time, probably in our past lives, right? So it's good to make that effort if you can. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to, you know, it's okay to rely on your strengths as well. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Alex.
Is there any other kind of religion that comes even close to
is there another religion that's come anywhere near dependent origination, or is there nothing before it or since? Would you believe me if I said that there are mysteriously similar statements to dependent origination found in the Egyptian pyramid texts? Yes? Maybe. Well, that would be a topic for one of the future discussions. Yeah. One of the future ones. Anyone? Just a couple of ones online. Vanessa asks: does less upadana means less sankara of choices, which then would affect your ability to move through different rebirth options, for want of a better phrasing? Yeah, it could be, right? So if you have, so sankharas, remember, sankharas are both good and bad, right? So you can have good sankharas and bad sankharas. And one of the things that the Buddha said is if you have good sankharas, it's in the Sankhara Upapatti Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya, right? So let's say you make good choices in your life, right? You live a good life, you're generous, you're kind, and so on. One of the benefits of that is that it gives you a certain degree of free will or choice in terms of where you're going to get reborn, right? And so let's say you have, as Venerable says, you have some upadana, right? You have some attachment. And maybe you say, oh, look, an obvious one might be, I love my country. I want to get reborn in Australia by the beach, so that I can enjoy the benefits of a lifestyle in Australia in my next life, right? Somebody else might think, I've heard that living in the realm of the 33 gods must be pretty good. So maybe I should get reborn there. And so as long as you have the karma that's appropriate for that, then to some degree you can do that based on your attachments, if you want to. Now, the Buddha wasn't necessarily recommending that we should. So if you don't do that, like if you don't like direct your consciousness, then karma will work in a more kind of natural way and determining your rebirth. Okay. Fine. Can animals be reborn in higher realms? Yes, absolutely. So animals, you know, all beings are going up and down all the time. So those beings in the highest heavens can be reborn in lower realms, and those beings in the lowest realms can be born in the higher realms as well. So Chandima says, thanks. Scott asks, how are you and your community engaging with or not with the barrage of American political horror? Scott, if you're interested in that, you can have a look. We have my talks are recorded and they're on a website, a link called lokanta.live. Maybe somebody can share that link. And the talks are recorded and they're usually uploaded to that. And I gave a series of talks earlier in the year on that precise topic. And the main message that I tried to give to people was that the Buddha's teachings give us a guide to how to build community and how to build society in a way that is just and fair, and that it's important for us as Buddhists to stick up for what is right, especially in very challenging times, and to hold the line and make sure that we keep the lights on. None of us obviously can control what's happening in the United States, but one thing that we can do is at least show them that darkness does not have to spread everywhere. So for us to not fall under the temptation to follow down that same road of darkness. And another way that I've been engaging with this particular issue is by telling people, do not under any circumstances go to America. And met some of our Anoma, who's a good friend of ours, who's just come back from visiting her family there. And when she was going there, I said, do not under any circumstances go to America. She's like, yeah, but my family's, I said, tell them to come to Australia, okay? She's like, oh, we've already got a flight. I'm like, do not under any circumstances go to America. Yeah, so anyway, so her husband gets arrested when they went there and gets questioned at the thing. I don't know about arrested, but anyway, he gets questioned. So he'd lived in Sudan or something beforehand. So they're fine and he didn't get put in jail or anything. But yeah, so let me repeat again in case my message was not clear. Do not under any circumstances go to America. And yeah, there's another link there. Thanks, Venerable Prasanna. So giving a link to a talk I gave some time ago on Not My Tomorrow, Reclaiming the Future from the Techno-Fascists. So that's another thing. Yeah, Scott says, my sister is going in November. She won't listen. Well, you can pass on my message if you like. Simran says, I'm literally joining online because this evening I was helping my mum and brother book their tickets to America. Sumana says, oh no, I'm going to the US in 2 weeks. I mean, what I would like to do at this point is like reflect on the nature of being a Dhamma teacher, okay? And if you think that being a Dhamma teacher means anyone's going to do what you suggest, here we go. Here's. Well, if you do go to America, number one, okay, if you do go to America, I have a couple of recommendations. First recommendation, if you go to America, number one, don't. Number two, that's it, okay? All right, so thanks, everybody. Do you guys want to make a bit of an announcement? We've got some folks here online. Do you want to do that? So we've got an event coming up here in Sydney. In a few weeks' time, and some of our Dhamma friends are here who are going to tell us a bit about all of that. So I'm going to hand over my seat for that. Okay, please come. You can come and sit. Why don't you both sit here? Okay. We can grab another seat, and you can both sit.
Hello. How are you guys? Okay, it's our turn.
You can go.
Okay, thank you very much. So actually on 24th of August, we will hold a 2025 Buddhist Dharma Talks and Empowerment in the afternoon, which we are very honored, you know, invited Ben Sujato to to have a talk. So I really wish, you know, all Ben Sujato's followers can go and support him. And it's a, you know, town hall to me. It's a very, you know, big space, and it's really a remarkable place of Sydney. And for Ben Sujato to have a Dhamma talk, to all the, you know, welcome everyone and, you know, give some, you know, come on.
Absolutely. So look, firstly, the event is free, while Town Hall is a great experience, and of course we'd love to have you there for that, it is a remarkable opportunity to learn from you know, multiple venerables, Bhante Sujato, of course, but we also have representation there in terms of unity of Buddhism from Mahayana and Tibetan Buddhism as well.
Vajrayana.
Yep. And in terms of the activity, so there'll be Dharma talks, of course. There's a lot to share and for you to learn. There will also be performances from different contributors at the event as well. So,
and the very interesting is there will be, you know, little kids, like not some are big kids from Shaolin Temple. They do Kung Fu on that day. Yeah.
So there'll be a Shaolin Kung Fu performance. There's a tea ceremony. Opportunity for participating.
The Mentor Center support on this event as well. Mm-hmm. So there will be very nice, you know, Buddhist, you know, Chinese tea, you know, ceremony, Buddhist, for everyone have experience and showcase it. And then lots of Dharma books. You guys, you know, once come, there are 30 minutes break. Can talk to any, you know, volunteers there from Metta Center, as well as some from the Vajrayana, you know, volunteers. They're all very lovely people. They all want to know you all. And
And there's the Korean Buddhist choir. There's a dance that will be done as well, which is the Lotus dance. And a range of activities there as well. So please do come along. It's a good investment of time. It'll be held on the 24th of August. There are multiple sessions during the day covering different things, but the main one really is the morning. From 9:30 till 12:30. So we'll share out a copy of, you know, a link or QR code or both in terms of opportunity for you to register. And we do encourage you to come along.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. But the most important part, fantastic.
Absolutely.
Do you mind I hand them out?
Yeah, please. Anybody who wants a leaflet or anything like that can promote, let people know. Great. Oh, thanks, Venerable Prasanna, for putting those details there. So, it's always really nice when we can organize an event for the whole Buddhist community, bring people together. And because there are a lot of Buddhists around there, and not just Buddhists, but people interested in Buddhism, you know, and people interested in what we have to say. And my personal belief is that we really need to, it's really important to build community and to build spaces where we can celebrate our shared values as Dhamma practitioners. And so I really have a lot of gratitude for all those who've been putting this on, and hopefully it'll be a wonderful event. So it's the 24th of August. Thanks very much. Thank you so very much. And let us finish up for today. And hopefully I'll be back at Crow's Nest on Wednesday, and I will be back here next Friday. Anything else happening? I think that's about it for now. Okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.